I'm Brian Lehrer. This is my Daily Politics Podcast from WNYC Studios. It's Thursday, May 13th. If you're following the news from D.C. this week, you probably know that the Republicans in the House of Representatives stripped Liz Cheney of her leadership post yesterday because she won't support the charade that President Trump would have won last year's election were it not for massive election fraud that nobody's been able to find. And we'll talk about that. But what all the Trump versus Cheney coverage might have made you miss from Washington was a really big climate story with implications for the New York, New Jersey area, as well as the nation as a whole. President Biden this week approved the nation's first really big offshore wind farm. It would be off the coast of Martha's Vineyard in Massachusetts, and they say provide enough power for 400,000 homes to be heated with electricity. Now, according to the New York Times, that's about 20 times as much power as the two existing offshore wind farms are producing combined right now, 20 times, in the waters near Virginia and Rhode Island, those two that are already in place. And here's the local hook. The president also designated some areas off Long Island and New Jersey for the next sets of big wind farms. Some fishing industry and beach community officials don't like it. But joining me now is a member of Congress who does. So with us now to talk about this unlikely pair of stories, the Liz Cheney story and the wind farm story, is Long Island Congresswoman Kathleen Rice, Democrat from Nassau County, a big proponent of wind farm development. Her district does include part of the South Shore from roughly Atlantic Beach and Long Beach out to around Jones Beach. Congresswoman, always a pleasure. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you so much, Brian. It's always great to be with you.
And let's start with the wind farms. For those who don't know about them, what exactly is a wind farm?
So I'm hoping that more and more people get to understand what this is. First, I just want to say, as you mentioned, Brian, I was so happy to hear the news out of Massachusetts that the Vineyard Wind Project has been given the green light by the Biden administration. This is going to pave the way forward for future projects across the country. Just to give you a little perspective as well, I was fighting when Trump was in office. I was fighting to get the Bureau of Ocean and Energy Management, called BOEM, which is a within the Department of Interior, to designate wind energy areas, because obviously Long Island is an area called it's called the New York Bight, and it goes. It starts out in Montauk and it goes all the way up to Cape May, New Jersey, which is an area rich in offshore wind development. So we were very happy that the new BOEM director finally named those wind energy areas. But basically what these are is offshore. So what people need to understand is this is not, they're not going to be eyesores. They are so far offshore, these wind turbines, that you won't even see them. And the reason why this offshore wind is so critically important for New York is because the legislature and the governor already has required New York to provide 9,000 megawatts of offshore wind power by 2035. So we're taking the state into a much more energy efficient direction. But on top of that, especially now that we're coming out of a pandemic, the number of jobs that this offshore wind development is going to create is just, it's tens of thousands of jobs, Brian. And I think we should all be excited about this. It's a critical priority for us on Long Island. I'm so happy that the Biden administration is taking action right out of the gate to jumpstart offshore wind development. So it's, if you look at what they're doing in Europe, they are so far ahead of us in terms of offshore wind and wind development. We have to catch up. The offshore wind industry is going to create, as I said, thousands of not just like low-paying jobs, but really good-paying jobs, and it's going to help us to combat the climate crisis at the same time. I understand people's concerns about what it's going to do to the environment. They already finished a supplemental environmental impact statement up in the Massachusetts area that I hope is going to lead us on Long Island to be able to go through that process even faster. But it's not going to, you won't even see them. It's not like you hear them. These are so far offshore that you won't even see them. But it's going to be a job creator, and it's going to be great for the environment.
Well, let me jump in on there where you said we're not even going to see them. There's an NJ.com story from a few weeks ago headlined, "Will Visible Offshore Wind Farms Sink Jersey Shore Tourism? The debate goes on." And relevant to your district, a story in Newsday in March, quote, Southampton Town Supervisor Jay Schneiderman, who says, quote, that area is too close to shore, in my opinion, where the wind farms would be and the wind turbines would be, and should not be considered. It appears to be 15 miles out in the ocean. That would make it very easy to see the large turbines, he says. These utilities need to be located farther offshore to eliminate the visual impacts from public beaches. So what's your response to the Southampton Town Supervisor on that quote?
I hear what he is saying, but I honestly can't. I mean, what are we talking about here? Okay, Brian, you can barely see these turbines. You drive through California, you go from, say, L.A. to Palm Beach, right, or to Palm Springs, and they've got the wind turbines on the land. Now, granted, they're not in residential areas, but they understand how important it is to develop wind energy. They are so far offshore that you're not even going to notice it. At its closest point, for instance, the project for off of Jones Beach State Park would be approximately 14 miles off the beach, okay? I don't understand why. I mean, at the closest point, you're talking about 30 miles off the east coast of Long Island. So I understand why, what his complaint is, but it is such a, it's not going to prevent people from going to the beach. You can still enjoy the beach. You're not going to hear the turbines. And I think that everyone has to kind of do their part to support at least New York State doing their part to go in a more energy efficient direction. We need to protect Long Island. And from an environmental standpoint, we are very vulnerable. We see these once in 100 year storms every year. So we don't have the luxury of what Mr. Schneiderman is saying. We don't have the luxury of complaining about an aesthetic when you're talking about creating energy to power millions of homes across New York State.
Elena in Westchester, you're on WNYC. Hi, Elena.
Yes, good morning, Brian. Thank you for the opportunity to ask your guest. Certainly appreciate the green energy, very much needed. However, I would like to ask, what are the effects on migratory birds from wind farms? Thank you, and I'll take my answer off the air.
Thank you very much. Congresswoman?
Well, Elena, that's a really good question. That is obviously one of these concerns that people have, not just the fish, but also the birds, because we know that they are obviously, you know, part of our beautiful ecosystem. And they have found that there are literally, I would say, a negligible impact on migratory birds. But again, this is a concern that we have heard, just like we've heard about the concerns about the aesthetics, even though you would not see, the turbines would not be larger than, I think it comes out to about a half an inch on the horizon. So, you know, that's a tiny, tiny, half an inch, you wouldn't even notice it. But that is a good question. And that, of course, the impact on migratory birds is going to be part of any environmental impact statement. I have to be honest with you, Elena. I have not read the full supplemental environmental impact statement that they did on the Massachusetts project, but I will. And I would be, you know, happy if you call my office. I'll be happy to get back to you on the specifics of that. But those are environmental concerns that we take into consideration, that, you know, regulators take into consideration when they talk about what the specifications are going to be for this kind of development.
I see you also have a bipartisan shoretown-oriented bill with Republican Long Island Congressman Andrew Gabardino aimed at staving off a big flood insurance rate hike that could take place this fall. Is higher flood insurance the result of sea level rise from global warming?
There's no question about it. And Brian, this has been an issue that has lingered since Superstorm Sandy, and we're trying to fix it. And I'm so happy to be to have this effort be bipartisan. One thing that New Yorkers and certainly Long Islanders should be very happy about is that regardless of the fact that we have two Republicans and two Democrats, actually three Democrats, because Greg Meeks has a part of Long Island as well, representing Long Island in Congress, I would say 10 times out of 10, whenever it's an issue that matters to Long Islanders and New Yorkers writ large, we are usually on the same page. And this is no difference. I mean, people got killed in Superstorm Sandy because they were desperate to rebuild their homes, and they took money that they believed they could get from many different sources, whether it was FEMA, the insurance company, any grant money. And then we found that a lot of this money they were trying to claw back because they should only have applied to one, or all this kind of craziness. But also now they're trying to make it prohibitively expensive for people to get flood insurance. And the rate hikes would just be very, very difficult for people to swallow. So that's why Andrew and I are working on this together. And we have to completely overhaul FEMA to begin with, but that's a discussion for another day. But I'm hopeful that we can make this fix so that people aren't killed. You know, they're trying to do the right thing and get insurance. I mean, as I said, we have these once in 100-year storms every year on Long Island. Power goes out, homes are flooded, you have to rebuild, you have to build them back up on stilts. And it's hard for homeowners to do the right thing when 6 months later they're told that they took too much money and they have to pay it back. So, or their rates go, you know, through the roof.
I guess the skeptic could ask, why put off the inevitable and make others subsidize it? You know, if the properties close to the shore are no longer viable because of more frequent floods or higher sea levels from global warming, why not acknowledge it and not build back there time and again, rather than keep subsidizing environmentally non-sustainable development with tax dollars?
Well, that's a question, Brian, that has flummoxed a lot of politicians, right? I know that the governor was kind of pressured to look at certain parts of Queens and Long Island to, you know, kind of say, okay, no more building homes here. But that is not a politically feasible, the response to that was not good, especially for the homeowners who would have been impacted, who would have had to leave the homes that they've been in for decades and decades. But you know what, this whole subsidy thing, we've been subsidizing big oil for far too long. We got to get rid of those subsidies and, you know, help people be able to live in their homes. If we would just take this state and this country into a more energy efficient direction, we're not going to have to worry about the flooding and the rising sea levels. We have to take care of this planet, especially when you're talking about Long Island. I mean, I don't ever want to leave Long Island. I've spent all of my 56 years on Long Island, and I live in the same town that I grew up in. And that's what we want to preserve for people. And, you know, we have to just kind of put our priorities in the right place.
Let's see. A lot of people still calling in and tweeting about windmills. And, you know, I mentioned I don't know how far the horizon is when you sit on the beach. So a number of people, you know, science geeks, math geeks, sailors, writing in and calling in. One person writes, for an observer standing on the ground with a height of 6'7", that's only Aaron Judge, probably nobody else, the horizon is at a distance of 5 kilometers or 3.1 miles. For an observer standing on a hill or tower 30 meters, 98 feet above sea level, the horizon is at a distance of 12.2 miles. That cites Wikipedia. That sounds small to me.
Yeah, somebody, 3 miles.
Somebody
yeah,
else,
I know.
Somebody else tweeted that they were in the Navy. I lost this tweet now, but it was something like they were in the Navy or a sailor or something, and the horizon from the shore is generally 14 to 15 nautical miles. A nautical mile is just a teeny bit bigger than a land mile. So that would make it around 15 miles. I guess it leads me to the question, if it's that close, why don't they just put it 18 miles instead of 15 miles offshore? Do you have any idea? And then nobody could complain that they would be visible.
So I am not an engineer, Brian, and I don't even act like I play one on TV, but those are considerations. I mean, by the way, I think that you can go out that far, and I don't know exactly how they decide how far off they're going to be. Obviously, all of the aesthetics are taken into consideration. the engineering ability to put it even further out. I don't know how they come up with that amount, with that distance.
And somebody else tweets, just looked, and there's an interesting history of Highlands on Wikipedia. There's a bit of a hill that served as a lookout during the Revolutionary War, and that's why a shore town can be named Highlands. All right, let's talk about, in our remaining few minutes, the other party in your Washington house, the Republican Party, the Grand Old Party, per its nickname and initials. What's the significance to you, other than to watch the Republicans be divided, of Liz Cheney losing her leadership role yesterday over her denunciation of Trump's big lie and the fake election fraud concerns?
Brian, this should be a concern for every single American, not just Republicans, not just Democrats, not just independents, every single American. What Kevin McCarthy engineered yesterday, with the full support, almost the full support of the House Republican caucus, was the biggest cancel culture moment that we've ever seen. The Republicans talk about Democrats being woke and all this cancel culture. They just canceled Liz Cheney because she told the truth about what happened on January 6th. In this Republican Party, Brian, Republicans are rewarded for lying and embracing extremism, and they are punished when they stand up for what is right. Matt Gaetz is still on his committees, huh? And Liz Cheney is now, you know, sent to Siberia? I mean, look, there are a few voices of reason on the Republican side, like Liz Cheney, like Adam Kinzinger. And by the way, there is very little from a policy standpoint that I agree with Liz Cheney about. But I really, it's sad that she is a sole profile in courage, along with people like Adam Kinzinger as well, and a handful of others.
You know,
I guess that's what it is.
I guess if people thought that Trump would go off after his loss and start a third party, remember all the talk about that? Does it now look to you more like the Trump wing owns the brand called Republican, and it's the conservatives like Cheney not promoting the election lies who would have to start a third party? And do you think she might?
Well, so let's just be clear about what the Republican Party is right now in 2021. It is a wholly owned subsidiary of Donald Trump. Okay, that's what it is. Would they be able, you know, I know that Adam Kinzinger talked about trying to start kind of an offshoot of the Republican Party. I don't know. You know, look at what we have in New York. I mean, it's impossible for there to be any party other than Republicans and Democrats. You know, independents go either way. They're not really considered a party per se in New York State. But that's really difficult. I really had hope. I was here on January 6th in the Capitol running from this crazy mob in the basement of the Capitol. And I thought to myself, my gosh, maybe this is going to be the moment. Maybe this will be the moment that we finally put aside mis and disinformation, this hyper-partisan atmosphere that we're living in, and we can all agree that what Donald Trump did by inciting that mob, that insurrection, was un-American and an attack on our democracy. That was what it was. But they look, Kevin McCarthy went down to Mar-a-Lago and kissed Donald Trump's ring, and now he said, okay, everyone, we're on the Trump train, or you're out.
Yeah, and we only have a minute left, but we should acknowledge that conservatives in Congress, some of them, are not crazy about the apparent replacement for Liz Cheney in that number three House Republican spot, a New York Congresswoman, Elise Stefanik from the Adirondacks, should probably be elected to that post on Friday, I see. But some conservatives in Congress are not crazy about Stefanik because she's voted with Democrats on a number of bills. There was a statement released, you've probably seen it, by Texas Republican Chip Roy.
He's going to challenge her.
He's running against her for this. So he
says, he's saying she's not a conservative.
Right. So here's some of his list: that she voted for legal immigration status for the Dreamers. She voted to condemn Trump's lawsuit to declare the Affordable Care Act unconstitutional, to overturn Trump's ban on transgender troops in the military, to put the U.S. back in the Paris Climate Accords. Voted for that, Chip Roy says, and some other things. So could the rise, and this is my last question, then we're out of time, could the rise of Elise Stefanik be bad for the truth about elections, but good for potential bipartisanship on some key issues?
Absolutely not. I mean, I ran with her, Brian, in 2014. The Elise Stefanik of 2014 doesn't even remotely resemble the Elise Stefanik of 2021. She supported the Equality Act 2 years ago, voted for it. 2 years now in this Congress, she voted against it. What's her explanation? Nothing other than political expediency, because she needs to get the conservatives like Chip Roy to support her to be in this leadership role, for nothing more than just her own political personal agenda. She is not going to bring the Republican Party to work in a kumbaya way with Democrats. That is not her MO. That's not her campaign. That's not what she's saying to fellow Republicans. She's saying we've got to go out there and fight these Democrats. She is not going to be trying to bring us all together here and heal the divisions that are just so rife here. So look, she's going to have a hard time. Chip Roy has said that he was thinking about challenging her because she's not a true conservative, and her record bears that out. But she has become a sycophant of Donald Trump and, mimics everything that he says. And look, at the bottom line, Brian, is Kevin McCarthy is not going to replace Liz Cheney with a man. So there's only a handful of women that it could be. And Elise Stefanik jumped into the void.
Congresswoman Kathleen Rice from Long Island, thank you so much for joining us as always. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Brian.
Brian Lehrer, a Daily Politics podcast, is an excerpt from my live daily radio show, The Brian Lehrer Show, on WNYC Radio, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, if you want to listen live at WNYC.org. Thanks for listening today. Talk to you next time.